This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The idea is that you and I step into a large room crammed with computers, maps, reference books and top experts whose only job is to give us the most thorough briefing possible on the burning questions of the day. And our singeing question today is all about the release of the report by Special Counsel Robert Mueller on Russian interference in the 2016 US presidential election. What's in it? And what does it all mean, especially for Donald Trump and his prospects for winning a second presidential term next year? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. One was low key.
After carefully reviewing the facts and legal theories outlined in the report, and in consultation with the Office of Legal Counsel and other department lawyers, the Deputy Attorney General and I concluded that the evidence developed by the special counsel is not sufficient to establish that the president committed an obstruction of justice offense.
One was happy.
I won. No collusion, no obstruction. I won.
Some were cross.
Criminal or not, it's immoral and it's undemocratic and, frankly, it's un-American.
The investigation has taken nearly 2 years, cost tens of millions of dollars, and led to dozens of criminal charges. Today, 4 hours ago in fact, a redacted version of Robert Mueller's report into whether Russia interfered in the 2016 US presidential election has been delivered to Congress, and the public got it a few minutes later. Today in the briefing room, I want to know what's in the report and what the implications are, both for US politics now and for the future. Get briefed with me in this edition of The Briefing Room. First, how did all this begin? What was Robert Mueller asked to investigate and why? I was joined earlier in The Briefing Room on the line from Washington by Katie Benner, a reporter for The New York Times who's been covering the investigation. Now, Katie Benner, what exactly was Robert Mueller asked to do?
In order to understand that question, we have to go back in time a couple of years to the summer of 2016, when the FBI and the Justice Department opened multiple investigations related to the upcoming presidential election, including whether the Russian government was interfering in that election and trying to somehow undermine the process to favor then-candidate Donald Trump, and whether Donald Trump himself was colluding with the Russian government in that effort. So that is something that was ongoing at the FBI and the Justice Department before the election. And then after the election, several things happened that were extremely startling, including President Trump's decision to fire then-FBI Director James Comey. It created a political maelstrom, and it was clear that things were very chaotic and very politicized inside of the department in a way that would make it difficult for these investigations not only to be completed, but for the public to have faith in their findings. So a man named Rod Rosenstein, who is the deputy attorney general, he decided it was time to bring in a special counsel. And that person is Robert Mueller.
Why Robert Mueller?
So Robert Mueller is an interesting figure. He is a staunch Republican. He was a former Justice Department official. He ran the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco. And he also eventually became the head of the FBI. So he had sterling credentials. And he served in the Bush administration and in the Obama administration. So even though he's a Republican, he was seen across the board as a straight shooter, as somebody who followed the facts and made determinations based on them and would not be swayed by politics.
How did the investigations kick off?
the roots of many of the things that Robert Mueller eventually made determinations on had begun before him. So what he was doing is he was taking those findings and evaluating them. And then he and his team, they began a tremendous amount of work. I believe there were 500 subpoenas, 500 interviews, lots and lots of paperwork, working around the clock to try to figure out what really happened.
Then we began to see that people were actually being charged. Who was being charged and for what?
We saw two different types of charges come out of the Mueller investigation. The first type was charges against Russians and Russian government-affiliated actors, basically showing that indeed the Russian government had worked very hard to undermine the election and to favor Donald Trump. There was a group of people who worked for the Internet Research Agency, and they were taking misinformation and disinformation and spreading it widely across social media. So this created both a lot of scrutiny for tech companies that had never happened before, and it gave us a real lens into how effective Russia had been in manipulating Americans when it came time for them to go to the polls. So that was one type of charge, and we also saw Russian agents charged with the actual theft of information. So we saw folks related to the Russian government had managed to infiltrate the email account of John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager. They had managed to break into the Democratic National Committee, the DCCC, other Democratic organizations, and steal information that they later disseminated over WikiLeaks and other websites to deeply embarrass Hillary Clinton, embarrass the Democrats, and undermine any authority they might have during this extremely fraught election period. So that was a really important discovery.
How close to Donald Trump did some of the charges get?
That brings us to the other type of charge. That was against people affiliated with Donald Trump and his orbit. Now, what's interesting about those charges is that those folks, whether it was Michael Flynn, his former national security advisor, whether it was Paul Manafort, his former campaign manager, whether it was Roger Stone, one of his longtime associates, none of those people were ever charged for working with Russia to undermine the election. They were charged for other things. They were charged for lying to investigators. They were charged for doing things like trying to impede the inquiry. And they were charged for financial crimes that were discovered in the midst of this 22-month inquiry. But they were never charged with actually working with Russia to undermine the election. Now, the third thing that the Mueller investigation was looking at, there was Russian election interference. There was whether or not Trump campaign world people were working with Russia. And then the third issue, which is the thorniest, is whether or not the president himself was trying to derail the investigation to such a degree that it would be considered a criminal act of obstruction.
Now, last month, Mueller finally delivered his report. What do you think we discovered from it?
So what we know already from the report is reflective of the indictments that he had already made public. He decided that, yes, Russia had tried to interfere in the election. He decided that, no, Trump World associates did not actively work with Russia. The third item, whether or not the president obstructed justice, interestingly, Robert Mueller and his team declined ultimately to say one way or another whether or not the president had committed a crime. And that created a new controversy here in the U.S. The attorney general, William Barr, who shared those findings, he decided to step into the breach and make that determination himself. So while Robert Mueller said, I cannot come to a conclusion about whether or not President Trump obstructed justice, William Barr said, you know what, I can. Based on the information in this report, I'm going to go ahead and say that the president did not obstruct justice, even though it's clear in the report, Bill Barr let us know, that Mueller's findings do not completely exonerate the president. It's clear in the report that President Trump did many things to try to undermine the validity and credibility of the investigation that Robert Mueller discusses and that he finds fault with, just not criminal fault.
That was Katie Benner of the New York Times on the background to the Mueller report. Although the full report that has been delivered to Congress has some redactions, we can now have an infinitely better idea of its contents than we had from the four-page summary that was released last month. Joining me now in the briefing room to discuss that full report and its implications are two people who've been digging into it since its publication. Dr. Leslie Vinjamuri, head of the US and the Americas programme at the foreign affairs think tank Chatham House, and Shira Shendlin, a retired United States district judge who joins us from New York. Leslie Vinjamuri, if I can ask you first, what stands out to you as the most significant aspect of this report?
Well, I think we absolutely cannot lose the number one point, of course, which is that it confirms Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential elections. That's tremendously important. The problem, of course, with the report is that much of that information has come out slowly. It's already been in the public domain. And so, in a sense, the report confirms something that people already knew to be true, despite, of course, the fact that the president of the United States frequently claimed that it wasn't. But I think the impact that it's having is much less significant than it would be if this was the first time that we were reading it and we were seeing getting all this information at once. But really, I think the significant thing about the report now comes down to this question of obstruction of justice, because it's been the thing that people have wanted to know because the finding was that it was inconclusive. And I think the fact that the attorney general so quickly, we remember when he first read that report, he gave himself 4 days to take a 448-page report that clearly said that it was inconclusive as to whether or not the president had obstructed justice. And in 4 days, the attorney general of the United States says he hasn't obstructed justice. So I think people have been waiting to see this report to look at those 10 incidents and the detail of that information. And actually, when you read it, it's deeply disturbing, much of it.
Shira Shendlin, does it disturb you too?
Oh, very much so. The report is divided into two volumes, and it's really volume two that drew my focus. As Leslie said, volume two is the obstruction of justice part of the report. Volume one is about the Russian interactions and their attempts to affect the election. But volume two is really dramatic. It's a two-year history of how President Trump, while he was president, reacted to this investigation ongoing while he was president. And of course, his very first reaction, and it's quoted in the report, is, "Oh my God, forgive me, I'm fucked. This is the end of my presidency." And those words that I just said are in the report.
Shira Shendlin, I'm glad you said them, but not me. That's all I can say.
Okay, but they're in quotation marks in the report. So they're not my words. They're the president's words. So he was clearly unnerved by this investigation. And what you find in Volume 2 is a careful, dramatic history, 11 specific chapters, so to speak, of everything he could think of to try to derail this investigation. And the report concludes, frankly, that he would have obstructed justice if his subordinates had carried out his instructions. I thought that was the most dramatic finding, that the only reason he didn't obstruct justice in the end is that everybody he told to do things said, essentially, no way, and didn't do what they told him to.
Sorry, let me understand that a little bit better.
Yeah.
Are you saying that he tried to obstruct justice, that that's clear within the report, and that Mueller says that,
but that he's
not guilty of obstructing it because he didn't succeed?
Well, those are my words. I don't find those words in the report. But the takeaway, if you read that section of the report, and the takeaway that I've seen by commentators already, is that he did order people to do things that would have resulted in obstruction, but they didn't follow his orders. So yes, you could say that is attempted obstruction of justice, but those would not be Mr. Mueller's words. I want to be clear about that. But he lays out in great detail 11 different efforts to derail this investigation that, if it had succeeded, in my mind, would clearly have been obstruction of justice.
Leslie Vinjamuri.
Yeah, some of that. I mean, I agree with much of that. You know, a couple of things stand out. He wanted his White House counsel at one point to tell the attorney general to shut down the investigation, to fire the independent counsel, Mueller. And again, as we know, did not do that. We wanted Comey to stop the investigation of Flynn. He wanted Comey to come out and say that the president wasn't under investigation, and Comey didn't do that. He wanted his attorney general Sessions to reverse his recusal from the process because he thought Sessions would protect him, and Sessions didn't do that. But the question of obstruction of justice, again, it is the ruling, the decision that Mueller made was simply based, it was inconclusive, right? He didn't say had these things happened, he would have been obstructing. He said it's inconclusive. And when you read the report, one of the things that's interesting is that he does suggest that part of the logic behind his, you know, prosecutorial judgment is that this is a sitting president of the United States. So it's very difficult to talk about obstruction of justice. So there are a lot of questions here about how the decision is being made about obstruction. If you go back to the press conference today, the Attorney General Barr saying, we need to talk about the context that the president was facing. So clearly, the Attorney General's decision, a lot of his thinking had to do with the fact that the president was under stress, and so, of course, he responded in particular ways.
Sheer Shendon, I hear that you want to come in, and then I want to turn to the question of what might happen in the House, in Congress, as a consequence of all this. But
okay,
respond to that first.
Then I'll do so quickly. I'll come in quickly. You remember that Mueller is a prosecutor, and a prosecutor brings criminal cases where you have to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So it wasn't so much about the sitting president part of it. I don't think that's it. He says, and I'm quoting, at the same time, if we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state. So he had no such confidence. What he worried about was proving it in a court of law beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's why if you read his recitation, you may not think you have enough for a criminal prosecution, but it takes your breath away to think that our president behaved in the way he did.
Well, that also goes to your point that that was not what people would have seen from the Attorney General's original description of the report when he had it before anybody else did. Now, let's turn to the question, Leslie Mitchell, of the implication that some people have seen in the Mueller report to Congress that actually there's stuff it can do that he possibly couldn't.
Well, I think the big thing here, and I think it is right, that there's a lot in there that it just wasn't necessarily provable. But the standard, of course, when we talk about Congress and oversight and hearings and the public reading the report, the standard then becomes something very different. And one of those metrics that's now going to be used to evaluate whether there was something that was obstruction or at least very, very wrong is whether or not the behavior associated with the president when it came to getting in the way of this investigation is something that should be that is appropriate for a sitting president in the United States. So Congress, of course, is going to investigate this. Mueller is going to be called to speak before Congress, as is Barr. It's not going away. It's going to have intense scrutiny at this point.
Shira Shendon, what could Mueller say before Congress that would actually push on from what the report essentially means?
Well, I think he would stress that he was operating under the criminal standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which Leslie and I have both now discussed. But if he outlines the 11 behavioral things that the president did, I think he will do it with some disgust and say essentially that this wasn't appropriate behavior. Whether it was criminal is a very different standard. But I think as people have time to absorb the findings in the report, they're going to be very disconcerted. Now, I realize we're sort of a tribal country, which means those who are on his side will say complete exoneration, and those who are not will be very disturbed by the findings here.
Now, you can be tribal as you like, but if something actually comes out that then goes to a court, then in that case, courts tend not to be quite so tribal. At least that's the perception.
Well, that's absolutely right. And there are ongoing investigations in several courts. There's investigations of campaign finance violations. There's investigations of the inaugural fundraising, his foundation and the use of it, tax fraud, bank fraud, money laundering. There's a whole host of investigations that are continuing, and some of them may lead right to the president's door.
Leslie Vinjamuri, is your feeling at the end of this, and I'm sorry to be so crude about it, that as Donald Trump has said today, it's actually, in the end, whatever people say, a win for him.
I don't think it's a win for him, and a lot will depend on the debate that takes place now around the report. Now, it's only been public for a handful of hours. This is very new information, and there is a question of to what extent the broader public will read it. Will his base read it? Unlikely that their minds will change. But there is a danger, I think, of course, for the Democrats, which is that it's imperative to read it. It's imperative to talk about it. It's imperative to have oversight. At the same time, that it's very important for all sides to continue to demonstrate that they have the future of America on their mind, that they're pursuing a positive and a productive agenda, especially as we move towards the primaries.
Leslie Vinjamuri, thank you very much. And to you also, Shira Shendlin, over there in New York. So finally, and inevitably, as the guests have already suggested, what are the implications for US politics, both now and looking ahead to the 2020 presidential election? Larry Sabato is Professor of Politics at the University of Virginia. Larry Sabato, there's quite some argument going on about what the Mueller report means just in the last few hours. Whose version of it do you think voters will believe?
I can tell you that very precisely. If you're a Trump supporter, you will believe the Trump White House version. If you are opposed to Donald Trump, you will believe the Democratic House's version. My translation of that is hardly any votes, maybe no votes, will be changed. People are hardened in their positions. They have known what they thought of Donald Trump for years now, and something like this isn't going to change very many people's minds.
Can we dig into this just a little bit? I mean, because I presume, I mean, we used to have this thing in Britain that every boy or girl born alive was a little liberal or a little conservative. But I presume that there are people in America who aren't actually firm Democrats or aren't actually firm Trump supporters. Insofar as we can tell where they tend to go on issues when they hear claims about something like this, how do they judge?
This is a highly partisan era. It's an extremely polarized era. And people are always surprised to hear this because often polls will suggest that 30 or 40% are independent. No, the vast majority of them actually lean to a party, and the leaners vote for the party as often as those who openly profess their admiration for a party. We're actually down to around 5 or 6% independents. That is, well over 90% have chosen a party. The vast majority of them have chosen either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. And their views are shaped by what the party leaders say.
That I had no idea that I'd read about independents there and thought that there genuinely were a large proportion of Americans who were undecided. So that tells me something that I didn't know. Now, bearing in mind what you've just said, there seemed to be what you can only describe as tacit invitations in the Mueller report to the Democratic Congress to take some aspects of what's in his report further, do something about it, even if he hasn't recommended action himself. Would you, if you were them, politically?
I would investigate, and I think that's exactly what they will do. Fortunately for the Democrats, the leadership of the party, including Speaker Nancy Pelosi, does not want to proceed to impeachment. They shouldn't do it. She's absolutely right for two reasons. First of all, that's not why they were elected. Most Americans say, you're not doing anything to improve my life. You're pursuing a political vendetta, however justified the vendetta. The second reason is because you're doomed to failure. Yes, it's perfectly possible to get a majority of the Democratic House to vote for impeachment, but impeachment is merely an indictment. Then it moves to the United States Senate, where a president has to be convicted by 67 of the 100 U.S. senators. There are 53 Republicans in the Senate. There is zero chance you would get even as many as 5 Republicans voting to oust Trump, and I wouldn't be surprised if there were 0. So it's pointless. The same thing happened with Bill Clinton in the late 90s. Why would you go through the extreme procedure of impeachment and conviction when you knew in advance you were going to be humiliated at the end?
Now, of course, it's quite possible that despite your words, there will be sections of the Democratic Party, including people in Congress, who actually think, no, we should do this. We should do something about it.
Yeah, oh, I think there absolutely will be pressure for impeachment. That's why it's so important to have the leadership opposed. And it's not just Nancy Pelosi. The senior leaders who thought about this understand what a political disaster it would be. So there are lots of ways they can derail it. And I think that's what will happen. But you're absolutely correct. You're going to have the noisiest parts of the Democratic Party demanding Trump's impeachment. That's where investigations can come in. They'll be happy, maybe satisfied, with some very thorough investigations that will produce embarrassing information about Trump that they can use in 2020 during the next presidential election.
So what you're saying is that Democrat activists and party members will be mollified by investigations they think are going somewhere against Trump and therefore won't make support for impeachment, let's say, a feature of supporting a candidate at the presidential primaries.
I think that's true. I can't be certain because a handful of very left-wing Democrats get a disproportionate amount of media attention. So it's going to seem like more of the rank-and-file members of the House of Representatives are in favor of it than actually are. But I think they can manage this because there's only one thing that all Democrats agree on. They want to get rid of Donald Trump in 2020. And they'll do just about anything to do that, including putting aside their preferences for impeachment.
Well, that's interesting, too. Now, we've been looking at the approval ratings for Donald Trump and seen that they've fallen to about 40% ahead of the report's release. Do you think that represents the kind of state of opinion that's likely to be around after, in the period after this report?
Yes, although I do disagree with the public opinion polls a bit in that I think they underestimate Trump's support. And I say that with bitter experience. In 2016, as everybody over here, we thought Hillary Clinton was going to win, and we've since done some additional analysis on polling. And in this particular case, I would say Trump is actually unmoved from Election Day 2016. He got 46% of the vote. And I would dare say if the election were held next week or a month from now, he would get 46% of the vote.
So despite all this, nobody has changed their minds.
And almost no one. You can always find an isolated example. But every bit of anecdotal evidence plus polling evidence suggests that Americans are dug in. We have a kind of demilitarized zone where the tiny number of independents may be located, but the vast majority of Americans, over 90%, are in the foxholes, red or blue on either side of the DMZ, and no one's crawling across the DMZ.
Now, one of the things that happens in our elections that actually determines them in Britain is differential turnout. In other words, they don't cross over from foxhole to foxhole. It's just that some people in the foxhole decide not to put their heads above the parapet when the shooting starts. Can you see any of this or any responses to it deterring voters from one side or the other, saying, well, I guess I just won't bother this time?
That's an excellent question. And what I think this report and the debate that we're going to be hearing over the next weeks and months will do is to energize both sides. The one prediction I'll make about 2020 this early is that we're going to have a massive turnout because both sides are going to be pulling their least interested members out of every foxhole they can find and getting them to the polls. I think people will be shocked by the level of turnout in the 2020 presidential election.
Well, that's an interesting prediction. And finally, Larry, again, from a kind of British perspective, what does it say about a country that no matter what a report like this concludes in your analysis, no one is actually affected by what it says?
I think it says that the country, in this case, the United States of America, is very stubborn. I don't think that will surprise many people looking at our history, but we're becoming even more stubborn in our political views. I don't think that's a good thing, and I think the polarization is becoming dangerous. It will lead to bad things in the next presidential term, regardless of who's elected.
Larry, thank you. Larry Sabato there with his rather doomy prediction. And my thanks to Katie Benner, Shira Shendlin and Leslie Vinjamuri. And we'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirstine Knight, Neil Koenig and Serena Tarling. The production coordinator was Icky Egbertola. The studio manager was Graham Puddifoot. And the editor was Jasper Corbett. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes, there are loads of them on a huge range of topics, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.